Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC. Transformation that works. With the tech to stay ahead and the know-how to act. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Emmet Oliver and this is the show that looks at business and politics on a wider perspective. And coming up today, gold. Why it's having a second coming in the era of Trump. Would you not buy a Tesla because of Elon Musk? We look at the effects a personality can have on a brand. Plus...
Hello, hello. This is 2LO calling. 2LO calling. Marconi broadcasting on behalf of the Broadcasting Committee on the 360-metre waveband from London, Marconi House, The Strand.
Yes, we look at the BBC World Service and ask what's its place in the modern world. You can email us, of course, at takingstock@newstalk.com. But now, they say in a crisis, gold is where you should go. Well, that seemed to be the case this week as the yellow shiny metal hit record highs heading towards $3,000 on the back of President Trump's love affair with tariffs. Of course, everyone is trying to find a safe haven where they can remove all the political, geopolitical risk going on with tariffs and, of course, what's going on in Ukraine. So is gold truly the safe haven and where is it likely to go next in terms of pricing? So joining me now is Russ Mould, who is the investment director from AJ Bell. Good afternoon to you, Russ.
Hello, Emmett.
Thank you for joining us. As we said in the intro, gold has traditionally been described as a barbarous relic, a safe haven, a gold, a metal holder of value. There's different ways to look at it, though. I mean, it has been breaking records pretty much since COVID. I'm looking back at the price graph when COVID happened, the next few months, it was up and up and up. It's had a few downswings, but it's pretty much been on a ceaseless rise. Where do you see this? Is this all just reaction to the politics of the era, the perma crisis, as a lot of people call it, or is there something more to do with just fundamentals of the asset itself?
I mean, you can argue that itself is an inert, useless metal, which, you know, those who think it's a barbarous relic will argue that it's actually not worth more than the, you know, incremental cost of digging it out of the ground, which right now for a major gold producer is probably around $1,500 an ounce. But what it has done in the past, if you look at, there have been three really big upward runs in the gold price since Richard Nixon took the dollar off gold and smashed up Bretton Woods, the gold standard in 1971, mid-70s, early 2000s, and now. And you could argue that inflation was kind of knocking around in some of those. There were worries over government spending in some of them in the early 70s, guns and butter. Now we've got government debt going through the roof in the US particularly, but also the UK and Europe. And in the early 2000s, it was, well, actually, you know, we've got a roaring economy. In all three cases, there was a little bit of a feeling of, are central banks in control? Are the authorities in control? And I think that's as much why people are looking for a safe haven right now. There's just an awful lot going on and they're looking for a place to hide.
Now, lots of assets claim to be safe havens. It's something investment managers and directors stick on quite easily in terms of advertising and promotional material. Obviously, we've got Bitcoin as well. We have a whole host of other cryptocurrencies, and they're now sort of nudging into this space, describing themselves or those assets as safe havens. Do you see gold and crypto as part of the same coin, no pun intended, or do you see them as having very different characteristics ultimately?
There's definitely a generation that see Bitcoin as digital gold, and the arguments for it are similar in that Bitcoin supply is capped at 21 million units. Gold, it's incredibly difficult to find, very expensive to dig out the ground, and supply generally grows at around 2% a year, which is an awful lot less than money supply has grown at in the last 5 years or so because of zero interest rates, quantitative easing, the response to, well, the great global financial crisis of nearly 20 years ago, and then COVID. So again, a lot of it is the supply of the asset relative to the growth in the supply of money, and both of them fit that tag. I guess the challenge with cryptocurrencies is anybody can set one up, or a meme coin, and I think that's possibly where the crypto investment case maybe isn't quite as strong in the eyes of certainly gold bugs, because let's face it, you know, President Trump and his wife set up their own collectible online coins the other week and watched the price go up and down like a fiddler's elbow.
Now, let's just critique it for a second and put it through a bit of a test. Obviously, gold doesn't produce any income, or certainly in most cases, it doesn't. Secondly, it has been on a good run, as you've said yourself, since COVID. I was saying it's pretty much been on a remorseless upward swing with a few interruptions here and there. So, you know, a rational investor might say this is not an income producing asset. It's probably a little bit overvalued, you know, because of all this geopolitics. So does that sort of work against it, or what store would you put on those arguments?
it's the Warren Buffett argument in an absolute tea. You know, he's famously quoted as saying, you know, we dig gold out of the ground, and then for some reason we put it back in a hole and put it back in the ground and sit on it. It's inert. It generates no cash. It has very limited industrial use, barring maybe in wiring for silicon chips. So he, for example, would not touch it at all. And I think he'd be pretty wary of gold miners, even though they can be very cash generative when the gold price is going well. So there are perfectly good reasons for not playing gold. And if you are thinking about it, it does need to fit within your risk parameters. But it has been money since time immemorial. It has proven itself to be a valuable portfolio diversifier during times of government debt accumulation or inflation or central bank loss of control. And that's the environment that people are latching onto at the moment.
Now, a lot of our listeners, they like all of us, they're subject to the lustre of gold. It has a certain mythology around it. But yet they're probably practically going, yeah, but how do I get into this sector? Do I go off and buy a gold bar, a sovereign coin? Do I put in myself into a gold fund? So if you're talking to me or anyone else and sat me down and said, what would you say is the best way for your ordinary retail investor to get into gold without putting huge risk onto themselves?
It's a good question. And again, if they feel that gold is right for them as part of a balanced diversified portfolio, you can own physical metal, but then you have to insure it and store it. So there are expenses to that. You can buy what's known as an exchange-traded fund or exchange-traded commodity, which is an investment that's just designed to follow the price of the precious metal. So it'll follow it up, but it will also follow it down one for one. And there's a little management fee knocked off that of a few percentage points. You can buy a fund of gold mining stocks, big caps or large caps, or you can buy individual gold miners, which is probably the riskiest end of the spectrum. So probably the easiest way of doing it, if you just want exposure to gold, is a gold tracker fund, an ETF. But then, and after that, you can maybe do it a little bit more expensively, doing it yourself by burying it in your back garden or putting it in the safe. Or you
go with the back garden option, yep.
Go with the back garden. Or you can get invested in gold mining shares, which can be great. But as we've seen recently with one or two stocks, say Barrick Gold of America and Resolute Mining, which is quoted in Australia and the UK, they're very active in Mali. The government in that African Republic has demanded a higher royalty, higher taxes, and a higher stake in future projects. So you can bump into resource nationalism. So if you're looking at individual gold miners, you then need to look at things like geology, where they operate, local taxes, local weather, and a host of other things, as well as management capability. So that is the more complicated, riskier end of the spectrum.
Okay, so just boil it down for me. Is it an ETF then? I need to get into a gold exchange traded fund? That's what I'm picking up from you.
The simplest way to get your pure, simple exposure to the metal price. Gold miners will go up more when the gold price goes up and go down more when the gold price goes down. So again, it's how much risk you fancy taking, how much sort of gearing you want into the gold price.
Now, we're talking about Trump and gold. So you could approach all of this as, you know, it's a bet on Trump and how out of the box his policies are going to be. So in other words, the crazier Trump gets and the more, I suppose, politically dangerous steps he takes on tariffs and, you know, wars and taking the sovereign land of other countries. You look at Panama and Greenland and so on. So is there a Trump trade in here where, you know, if you think Trump is going to really do something even more outlandish than he did in his first presidency, gold is a way to sort of insulate yourself to that. Is that how you see the trade?
I mean, some economists are worried about tariffs promoting, stoking inflation. And again, gold, because of its limited supply growth, is seen as a hedge of that and a way of preserving the purchasing power of your cash. If you look at Trump, markets are generally were very excited about him back in November, remember, because of him looking to cut taxes, slash regulation, cut government spending and try and bring some discipline to the US budget deficit. So there would be, you could argue, potential positives that would perhaps put gold back in its basket. Equally, trade wars, domestic political retribution, scope for foreign policy misadventure are all potentially volatility creators, and that's probably what investors are looking to hide from. So if you think he's going to do the good things, you won't be interested in gold. If you're worried about the bad things, again, that may be one of the reasons why it's going up at the moment.
Now, obviously, it's a big mover correlating into inflation generally. You know, it's a store of value, effectively. So what inflation is doing is always important in moving this particular asset. Okay, inflation remains a problem. We saw it edging up during the week in the US to about 3%. But central banks generally, they're on the case. Inflation is falling from its highs. They're getting it down. You know, the Jerome Powell will leave rates at a certain level until the job is done. The ECB are somewhat in the same position, although they've adopted a diverging policy. But, you know, in other words, is the sort of the gold story a little bit of a year and a half old, in the sense that, inflation is generally being brought to heel, so that's not quite as good for gold, or where do you sit on that?
No, if you believe that, then I think you would be reluctant to get involved with gold right now. But there's a case out there that central banks were behind the curve when inflation shot up, saying it was transitory, which, you know, potentially didn't look quite so smart. And there's a case to be made now that much as they would like to perhaps cut interest rates to stimulate growth and make government debts more affordable, again, with inflation above target and looking a bit sticky, looking a bit resilient, unemployment is low, wage growth is still good, it might not be as easy for them to get inflation under control as they would like, because they're under pressure to cut rates, to get growth going, and again, help with those government debts. The US government's annualized interest bill is now $1.1 trillion. That's doubled in the last couple of years. It's nearly a fifth of the tax take. Powell will be looking, I know it's not his mandate, but he'd only be human if he wasn't looking at that, thinking that you might need to provide some assistance. And that chap Trump is again already pressuring the Fed to cut rates. Maybe that's one of the reasons why. And if the Fed seems to be cutting rates aggressively when inflation isn't back in its box, that's the sort of thing that gold bugs are looking for.
Now, obviously, we've seen some dramatic headlines in the last few days in the Financial Times in particular about London, because a lot of this gold is sold, traded and administered in out of London, even more so than the US. But we're seeing these stories about gold, big lorries and ships full of gold heading to New York, like actual physical stocks of gold moving from London to New York. And it's all connected into the whole Trump era. Just can you walk me through why that's happening, or what's causing that?
Central banks have bought over 1,000 tons of gold for each of the last 3 years, according to the World Gold Council, and they're becoming increasingly aggressive buyers. Now, again, is this because, I mean, some of this is thought to be because some central banks are looking to diversify away from the US dollar. Now, that might not be some of the major Western players, but it could be the Russians, it could be the Chinese, who, let's face it, are currently on the end of sanctions and may not want to be found holding too many US dollar assets in case the Americans get tucked into them again on the sanctions front. So that is one possible explanation for that, which may have been a further accelerant of why gold is doing well. There are also rumours going around that Chinese banks are running out of gold when clients end up looking to buy the stuff. I wouldn't want to get too hung up on the Chinese story, but the fact that you're having to wait 4 to 8 weeks for physical delivery in London does suggest that there is a lot of demand out there for gold and there isn't as much supply as you might think.
And do you have any idea why London has kind of retained its position as the sort of gold city? I mean, obviously it had it from previous centuries and so on, but it does seem to have a strong position in the trading of this metal.
Yeah, the London Metal Exchange, it's a phenomenally strong player on the global stage. You've got huge banks with depositories here. So I think that's as much as a historical quirk as anything else.
Now, a lot of our listeners are intrigued by gold. You know, some of them may just buy shares. They may just have a portfolio administered by their pension fund manager and so on. But they're also intrigued by the other metals, and they probably know a little bit less about them. You've obviously got silver, you've got copper, you've got aluminium, which is used in industrial processes. You've obviously got steel, I suppose, but you've got all these different metals, some of them rare, some of them more plentiful. So should we play the metals market more generally and look beyond just gold?
Again, there is an argument that commodities provide some diversification. A classic portfolio will contain some shares. It may contain some bonds or fixed income or loans to governments or companies. It may have some property in it, but commodities do tend to match to their own beat. Some of it is related to the industrial economic cycle, like, say, Dr. Copper, which is seen as a huge nickname, so because it's a huge guide to global economic health. It's ductile, it's malleable, it's conductive, so it's used in everything from cars to buildings to kettles, so it's a good play on the global economy. So that's one way of looking at that. Gold and silver as precious metals, not so much industrial use, though silver is used in solar panels, for example. They're seen more as, you know, havens, they will say. And gold and silver is actually at a 12 or 13 year high, you know, knocking around the $30 an ounce mark right now. And that's, again, seen as a haven against central bank money printing or loss of control or inflation. So they all have their own different movements. I mean, nickel, for example, is at the moment moving around in a very volatile way because Indonesia is a big supplier there and it's looking to limit exports and keep more of the goods for itself. So if you do get into commodities, you really, really, really need to be on top of not just the metal price itself, but geopolitics, economics, and some of these intricacies. So it's not an easy place to go looking for quick money. You know, you really do need to do your research and know your stuff. Again, therefore, to help you, you can buy broad baskets of these things that follow a range of different raw materials if you feel it's the right thing for you. But if you want to get into individual metals or individual stocks, you really better know your stuff or you could end up in trouble.
Okay. That's a nice diplomatic way of saying bust. You know, you could lose your life savings and find them disappearing. As you said earlier on, there's different ways to do it. So I think from a listener's point of view, just be very careful. Look at the commission, look at the performance of it in previous times. And is it liquid and can you get it out if you're stuck at a particular time? Because I know a lot of people, as they find themselves in personal crises or financial crunches, they need to get the money reasonably quickly. For now, thank you very much for guiding us through that. There's Russ Mould, who is the investment director of AJ Bell. This is Emmett Oliver here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we'll ask what's the role for the BBC World Service in this day and age. Now, this is Emmett Oliver here on Taking Stock. Now, it conjures up a voice of hope and reason in the wilderness. The BBC World Service is known across the world. And of course, its impartiality is never questioned. It's often seen as really, I suppose, an example of how a country can wield soft power as opposed to belligerent hard power, which we see in some other contexts. However, its place in the world is under threat. UK budgetary constraints are one of the reasons, and there are fears that voices from other countries, such as Russia or China, may also step into the broadcasting void. So joining me now to look at this global institution, can it be saved? Should it be saved? Is Professor Stephen Barnett, who is a Professor of Communications in the Westminster School of Media and Communications at the University of Westminster. Good afternoon to you, Stephen, and welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on.
Listen, this is a huge institution. A lot of our listeners will obviously know the BBC. They'll pretty much know the BBC World Service. But give us an idea of just the size and scope of this organisation, because maybe we don't fully appreciate what a behemoth it is.
Size and scope in terms of its UK coverage or throughout the world?
Yeah, throughout the world. Or
maybe we can do both. I mean, essentially, the domestic service is it's £3.5 billion. Covering 10, 12 TV channels, a plethora of radio stations, and of course, an online website, news website. So it reaches the current, on current figures, it reaches about 98% of the population on a weekly basis. So it is an integral part of Britain's cultural and democratic life. Despite the huge number of social media sources, other news sources, the BBC still stands within the UK as by far the most trusted and most used institution for news and information, for trusted news and information, which is obviously is an important rider. But in terms of its coverage around the world, it's the original aim, the objective was to reach 1 billion people. It's around 600, 700 million people who will listen to the World Service either in their native language or in English. So the BBC does both. It will broadcast in about 45 native languages and obviously in English around the world.
Yeah,
it has to choose its regions carefully as well as its...
It's an incredible reach that really, as you say, very few other media organisations, maybe none, can actually emulate. Obviously, though, at the same time, the figures in some senses don't speak for themselves, because it sounds like, you know, people within the UK are not entirely convinced of its utility, you know, and its value. Not every party, of course. We have, until recently, a Tory administration in the UK, now replaced by Labour. But there has been cuts. There has been some challenge and critique of the service. So why isn't what seems very much just an obvious asset for Britain globally, why is there any questioning of it at all? Or is there something to do with the political waters in Britain that's making that happen?
It's such a good question. Every time I do these interviews in countries around the world, it sort of starts with a paean of praise to what the BBC does, its position in the world, how important it is, its the position of the soft power that it brings to the UK. And yet, within the UK itself, there are successive governments, both Labour and Conservative, but it tends to be mostly Conservative, have asked questions, have cut the budgets, have said you need to rein in the kinds of programmes that you're making, partly because they come under a lot of pressure from private companies, publishers in particular, newspaper publishers who don't like the idea of a free and trusted news service, but partly because certainly on the right, there has always been a distrust of a publicly funded organization. So you have this this paradox that you have a worldwide behemoth, which is trusted with a fantastic reputation around the world,
but at home is consistently under attack and being told to make cuts. And since 2010, the BBC has had as lost 30% of its funding under progressive, successive Conservative prime ministers.
Now, I obviously described it in my intro as impartial. I believe it to be the case, but of course, nothing ultimately is impartial and there's biases in everything. Is this part of the attack on the BBC World Service? As you've mentioned, certain political forces, are they worried about the editorial line of this, or is it just seen as, why do we particularly need this? I'm just trying to get a sense of where the critique is coming from.
It's both. So, and again, it's interesting, when a Labour government comes in and the same thing happened in 1997 under Tony Blair, there is a sea change in terms of the political environment for the BBC. It's much more benign now under Keir Starmer than it has been for the last 14 years. So I'm talking about essentially under Conservative governments. It's attacked for both reasons. First of all, it's ideological. It's because we don't like the idea of a publicly funded body when we've got so many private channels who are trying to make a living from doing the same thing. But the other thing is impartiality. The right have been always convinced, because it's a publicly funded body, that it's going to be partial. It's too left-wing. It's the journalism is coming from a progressive standpoint. Now, all the research, and I've seen masses of it, all the research that's been done academically comes to the same conclusion. There's absolutely no evidence for saying that the BBC is partial, that it has a partisan bias. But certainly from the right, there is this perception that it's not on their side. And that has been a problem for decades, frankly.
Now, obviously, you know, looking in, at least superficially, you think the Labour Party are in power. They're generally more well-disposed traditionally to public sector broadcasting, the Tories less so. So would it be fair to conclude from that that it's broadly safe for the next few years unless the Tories come back or reform or something like that? Or do you think even within Labour's time, its future is not necessarily guaranteed?
No, I would say, and I hope I'm not caught out on this, but I would say its future is, if not assured, is much safer than it would have been had there been another Conservative government. Your listeners may not be aware, but there is a royal charter that governs the BBC, and that comes up for renewal every 10 years. It just so happens that the current charter runs out at the end of 2027. So it will be renewed, and the terms of the charter will be renewed under this Labour government. And I think we can already see that the signs coming out of Downing Street, coming out of the Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, that we want to see a well-funded and properly resourced BBC doing all the kinds of things that it's been done before. They have already given it an extra £30 million, given to the World Service an extra £30 million. It was half of what the BBC actually wanted, but it's a start. And that money will go towards trying to shore up some of those global services, the overseas services that have had to be cut back over the last 40 years.
Yeah, could I actually direct your attention onto those a little bit, moving a little bit away from the BBC? Obviously, the Americans have had Radio Free Europe for a long time. I know the French are now, they have their own sort of English language, would you believe it? French news service on television. I'm sure there's things like Al Jazeera and so on. So there's a lot of arms of various states and state-sponsored groups involved in this area. Obviously, we've seen RT, the propaganda arm of the Putin regime, and China has a number of services as well. So this is getting congested stuff. An area where the BBC probably had it to themselves for quite a while is now very, very competitive. What have you got to say about some of these others? And could the BBC, if it pulls back and gets less money, be kind of elbowed out of the way?
Yeah, that is exactly the danger. And it's already happened in one or two places where the frequencies that the BBC were broadcasting on, where it's had to cut its service, has been taken over by a Russian service. And that is the danger. And I think there's a danger, particularly given the global uncertainty of the world at the moment, that this government is aware of. And it's one of the reasons it was prepared to say to the BBC, yes, you can have an extra 30 million now. And we'll see what we can do in terms of the next charter and the funding arrangements. But you're right, of course, that it's become more congested. I think what the BBC still has is the legacy of a reputation rooted in impartiality. Now, of course, if you're sitting in Russia or you're sitting in China, you wouldn't regard the BBC as impartial. But from the perspective, from a Western perspective, it is not a propaganda outlet in the same way as you mentioned RT or the Chinese TV channel, or frankly, even some of the French and American channels, which are inclined to put out their own country's propaganda, and are certainly within the countries where they're received are seen as propaganda outlets. It's fair to say, I think, that the BBC is still seen as the place where you can go for genuinely trusted information about what's going on in your country, in particular in those regimes which are run by authoritarians, dictators, and it's difficult to know exactly what's going on.
Is it also, you know, a more basic question here? You know, a lot of the politicians in Britain wake up in the morning, they switch on BBC Radio 5, 4, they have obviously Times Radio, there's all sorts of services, so they don't hear this a lot, whereas the audience do in Africa, in South America, in parts of Europe, Asia, and so on. But, you know, from Boris Johnson to Keir Starmer to whoever, it's not part of their daily lives. Does that mean it's a bit of out of sight, out of mind? Is that one of its challenges?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's a message that is gradually getting home, particularly given the worldwide instability at the moment, which is, you know, coming further and further towards us. As Donald Trump makes it clear that he doesn't want to support Ukraine, the plans that he's got for Gaza and the Middle East, there is more sense of instability. And I think there is a growing awareness now that to have an organization that is rooted in the values of this country, but also rooted in a reputation, a tradition of genuine impartiality and truth-telling, that notion of truth-telling, which is under attack today more than it's ever been before in sort of post-enlightenment era, is becoming more and more important. And I think you're right that in terms of the domestic priorities, prime ministers do not wake up thinking about the World Service. But I think there is a greater awareness now of the global risk of disinformation and the part that the BBC can play, given its reputation, given its size and scale and its history, in actually doing something about that.
Well, it sounds like they're ticking that box marked relevance very firmly based on what you're saying. As you said, because of all the disinformation, maybe they'll find their calling, whether the financial backing is there or not, we'll have to see. But hopefully it'll be there. Certainly enjoyed listening to it fleetingly over the years, but I've always liked the quality that they pumped out and broadcast. So listen, thank you for walking us through its future challenges and whether it can survive or not. Professor Stephen Barnett, who is a professor of communications at the Westminster School of Media and Communications at the University of Westminster. We really enjoyed having you on Taking Stock.
Thank you very much. Very good to be on it.
Now, you're welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver. Now, according to recent data, Tesla has posted lower sales figures across 5 European countries in the month of January. Among those countries was the UK and France, as competitors with newer models gained on the electric vehicle maker. And polls also show that public opinion is souring on individual owner and the driving force of Tesla, Mr. Elon Musk. But to what extent does a CEO's personal brand affect sales of their products? Or is it all down to his political leanings at the moment lowering those sales figures? And I'm now joined to discuss these broader issues by Gretchen Larson, who is a professor of marketing at Durham University Business School. Welcome to Taking Stock, Gretchen.
Thank you.
Now, nice, Gretchen, it's great to have you. As you have been doing some research, we thought we'd talk to you. And one of those things, first of all, is just leaving Elon Musk and parking him aside, no pun intended, for a second. Is there a connection at a basic level between the identity of the leading personality in a company and their reputation? And does that influence that company's brand and the reputation with the public? Can we connect those two up?
Absolutely. The identity of the CEO is really connected to their reputation. Very often, the stakeholders, the general public, and various other people interested in an organization will see the CEO as a personification of the brand itself. And so the personality characteristics, the specifics of the individual person, will shape how they're understood as a CEO. And then that is used by people to understand really something about the company that they're representing. And that can have a really big impact on really the bottom line for companies as well. So in addition to the company's reputation, it can have an impact on shareholder return, market capitalization, and so on to quite a large extent.
Yeah, and I suppose some companies, you know, swing the other way. They elect or they pick a very anonymous CEO who's not promoted, maybe does the odd media interview, but generally much stays in the background and doesn't have that cult of personality that some CEOs seem to like to invent around themselves. So you are building up risk, I guess, once you go the other way, where you invest huge resources and brand value in one particular person. They can be found in a compromised position in a hotel room. Obviously, they can be responsible for some statements that leave the company cleaning up the mess afterwards. So you do build risk up. Yes, there's a reward, but the risk reward, it's considerable. Is that where the problem is? Just this idea that you're putting all your eggs in one personal basket and it can go disastrously wrong?
Yeah, absolutely. There can be a real problem. If there's a real alignment between the CEO brand and the company brand and the values and that they hold to be important, that's a real strength. But if for some reason those become misaligned, maybe they do something that was unexpected or morally problematic, then that can be a real issue for the brand that they represent or various brands that are also connected to that organization as well. And I think we've seen a couple of examples of that, you know, happen over the years.
Yeah, and here in Ireland, we've obviously got Michael O'Leary, the key driving force behind Ryanair. A lot of people have often said to me, well, when you have someone like him who's so, I suppose, in your face and takes up a lot of psychological space, you don't need an advertising campaign. He's a walking advertising budget. I mean, in this case, we've got Elon Musk. I would argue, and this is just pure personal reflection, that there's two cults out there, or semi-cults or quasi-cults. One is the crypto Bitcoin cult. People really passionately believe in that asset class. And then you have people who believe in Tesla cars. They really will talk to you for 10, 20 minutes about all its features. They'll speak to it about it, not like it's a normal car, that it has some sort of magical properties. Do you think that's down to him and the mythology around the cars, or is it the mythology around him? What's your own sense of that?
I would say they're probably interconnected in that sense, but certainly Musk himself seems to really inspire quite a great amount of loyalty amongst consumers. So there will be people that have followed him along with his various ventures over the time, seeing him as a visionary and therefore, you know, being very supportive and very loyal to the different ventures that he undertakes. And I think some of those will be people who have purchased and drive Teslas. There'll be other people that have come to Teslas as consumers more around the environmental concerns that they might have, values around sustainability and so on, who may have been less driven by it being associated with Musk himself, but the two of those become kind of intertwined in the experience for consumers of having a Tesla.
Yeah, because it's frustrating for probably me and you to kind of get a sense of this latest sales drop. What's the cause of it? I mean, you know, one of it is there's a new model coming out, so some people are holding off there. Another possible explanation is there's less government support for buying EV vehicles and battery-powered vehicles. The third piece is that political piece, which I suppose myself and yourself are interested in, but we have to be careful not to get too carried away. So do you put it down to, it's probably never just one reason, but how substantial would you say politics is in lowering those sales figures? Just what's your sort of first impression or your reaction to that statement?
Well, I agree completely with you that these things are never down to one factor. And I'm sure that there's been the fact that there's been an increase in choice for electric vehicles for car buyers will have also played into the particular impact on Tesla itself and that the other factors that you've outlined. But a survey that was done in January of this year by electrifying.com showed that 59% of car buyers are now saying that Musk's controversial reputation has actively actually put them off buying a Tesla. And those are both current electric vehicle owners and prospective electric vehicle owners. So I think that that's quite a big indication that his recent kind of controversies and activities and political views probably have really impacted that downturn that's specifically for Tesla. Because from what I understand, the electric vehicle market is still rising somewhat. So for that to happen to Tesla I think it might, we could probably safely assume that that has something to do with it.
Yeah, and he kind of has shot himself in the foot a little bit in the sense of the countries he's let down are irritated. Germany, such a big market for EVs. That's one of them. France, again. So I mean, if he was going to annoy Europeans, Germans and French, probably not a great place to start. You might be better off annoying us here on this island first, because it's not a huge part of the market. But the German piece, the thing he did, the simulcast with AfD, the party, very controversial, I think, any far-right party. You know, he's sort of gone in deep into this and alienated people in very key strategic markets in particular.
Yeah. Yes, for sure. But I think what's really important to pick up on is that when consumers who might have been really loyal are alienated, then they can actually become almost activist against a brand, and that can be really problematic for an organization going forward. It's not just that people will just kind of switch to another brand and not say anything about it. If they've been very loyal to an organization, when something like this happens, they will actually almost become kind of anti-fans or spokespeople against a brand. So that can be really problematic. And I think when it's tied into really important cultural values and so on, as you've indicated, in places like Germany and France, then that's going to be even more deeply rooted.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose the other interesting thing about Tesla is, of course, they haven't traditionally sold their cars in the local garage or showrooms. They've gone online. Now, they've slightly tweaked that recently, but that's what they were known for, just taking out the garage part of the supply chain. So they've always been a bit of a disruptor. So maybe this is a case of maybe they've gone too far on the disruption. It's come from politics, but maybe they've taken their customers for granted because they saw the loyalty and the fandom that was around this brand. And maybe just he's got a bit complacent. He's obviously involved in these cuts to federal programs and so on in the US. But maybe his shareholders and his board, well, though less so the latter, they might start taking the view that, look, you need to concentrate on your day job, which is this brand, Tesla, and sort of almost take away any, you know, spillover from these other issues that is spilling over onto the brand. Maybe that's where we're going to go.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you're right to pick up on this idea about the you know, there is a belief that if you've got really loyal customers that we might frame as being fans, even, that they, you know, that they're so loyal that they're going to stick by you no matter what you do. And the research that myself and my colleague James Obiegbu have done shows that actually being critical is an element sometimes of being a fan. Sometimes it comes from a place where fans, you know, are so supportive they want to see the CEO or the company do really well. So they're critical of what they're doing because they want to see them do better. But sometimes it can also, if a brand goes too far, then it can make someone turn the other way because they see themselves no longer aligned with that at all.
And I don't want I don't want to embroil you in this one, but we obviously had martial arts fighter Conor McGregor recently in a court case here in Dublin. He has a whiskey product that kind of went south very, very significantly after the case. Obviously, we know about James Dyson, a big backer of Brexit. He was sort of a, I suppose, very much lauded or eulogised figure before that. So there does seem to be something in what you're saying of the other brands and what way we brand companies. There is some kind of disconnect there.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think that's something to be really wary of. I mean, many brands want to work hard and do work really hard at creating really deep connections with their consumers. And this idea of this very dedicated, very committed kind of consumer is something that would be seen as an ideal for many brands. And that can be a really positive thing. But I think when you are connecting particularly with people brands, people as brands can be a little bit more unpredictable than perhaps a product brand, sometimes a little bit uncontrollable. And then that might lead you back to that idea of that being a really risky investment if that person brand somehow does something that doesn't align with the company values anymore. And then you can lead, you know, you can end up in that situation where you're actually alienating people and you know, polarizing them around particular issues. And you don't want people to go out against your brand. You don't want people to be, you know, actively saying negative things about you either. And so that's the risk.
Now, Gretchen, we'll always have someone roaring at the radio at this stage of the interview, both of us, by the way, not just you, but saying, does any of this matter, you know, forget branding. This is all about, is the vehicle affordable? What's its functionality? What speed does it get up to? How does the battery charge up, and what do you get out of it? In other words, all this branding stuff is interesting to people like Emmett and Gretchen, but like a Ryanair ticket, I don't really care what Michael O'Leary is saying. I just need to know, can he get me to Stansted for 20 euros or whatever it is? So just to put that to you, how important is any branding, or is it the functionality and the cost and price of a product really, in the final analysis, what matters?
Well, there's a lot of research exploring that. I'm sure it doesn't surprise you to hear that.
And let me guess, it sends out a very mixed picture.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's lots of reasons why we buy things, lots of reasons why we consume things. And, you know, at the very kind of basic level, we're not going to buy and consume things that don't work or that they don't serve the purpose that we want to buy them for. But very often, many of the choices that we have are functional. And so then what we start to do is choose between different options in the marketplace based on things like what they mean to us. So what the products tell us and tell other people around us about who we are, who we're connected with, who we're not connected with, our status in society, the kind of values that we hold, elements of our identity. We can also consume things because of how they make us feel. Maybe they make us feel good or excited, or maybe even sometimes we might want to feel scared, and that's why we undertake sort of adventure tourism and things like that. So there's a whole range of different reasons why people buy things, and it can be a mix of those things, or for some people it might be more one thing than another. So I think that there would definitely still be purchasers of Tesla who would do so because they see it as a really good car that functions well and is maybe affordable in their price range and so on. But there will be others that where the identity, symbolic and experiential elements are equally, if not more important. And those are probably the ones that are at risk with a brand in this kind of situation.
Yeah. And obviously the other big challenger in this category is, you know, the Chinese vehicles, the BYDs and so on, which are kind of promoting a slightly different brand value. They're sort of, again, they're very much playing down the China connection. And again, anything political about the regime of President Xi and so on, they're playing up the quality, but also what you get the quality for the price that you're having to pay. So it's probably what's a traditional Chinese branded offering where, look, you get all this for the lowest price in the market, and it's kind of leading edge, even though the price is not that high. So I suppose they're going a different direction. So it's two very contrary offerings between what Elon Musk is offering, which is more expensive and a premium product, versus a BYD. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, the two options there in cars, where brands does seem to really matter.
Yeah, sure, for sure. And I think it's always good in a marketplace to have a range of different options available to people. Arguably that makes the marketplace more competitive, but it also means that people can buy for the reasons that are important to them as well, and that they have choice. And we see choice as being an important value in the marketplace, but also, you know, in life and democracy more widely.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see. The next set of sales figures will tell all. Maybe it was just a blip. Maybe it was just because the Trump noise was very loud during January. So, but I think we'll have a pretty good idea by the summer, because most of the time these are monthly figures that come true. Is it just a one-off thing, or has his personal brand spilled over onto the car brand? And if it has, what does his shareholders and so on think of that? Because they'll still want their return, whether he's helping President Trump or not. So even Elon Musk faces some constraints. For the moment, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for walking us through what are a whole broad set of issues. Gretchen Larson, who is a professor of marketing at Durham University Business School, we appreciate you joining us on Taking Stock.
Thank you.
And that is it for this week's edition of Taking Stock. This has been Emmett Oliver. I'll just remind you, of course, the show is available as a podcast first on Friday morning on the News Talk app or wherever you go for your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning from 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day.